Welcome to the Long COVID podcast with me, Jackie Baxter. I am really excited to bring you today's episode. Please do check out the links in the show notes where you can find the podcast website, social media and support group, as well as a link to buy me a coffee if you are able. You should not rely on any medical information contained in this podcast and related materials in making medical, health-related or other decisions. Please do consult a doctor or other health professional. I love to hear from you. If you've got any suggestions or feedback or just want to say hey, then please do get in touch. I really hope you enjoy this episode, so here we go. And welcome to this episode of the Long COVID podcast. I am delighted to welcome my guest today, Peter Burt. I got an email, I think it was before Christmas, from this total unknown person. And this happens quite a lot, and I love hearing from people. But this particular email really resonated with me because I thought, a guy talking about mental health. Okay, we need to do this. And so you've been persuaded to do it. And here we are today. So a very, very, very warm welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Jackie. Yeah, thank you for having me on. It was, I was actually sat in a hospital car park waiting for a CT scan. And I was just listening to one of your episodes. And it was the whole episode just resonated with me. It was almost like the things you were saying and everything he was talking about just seemed to be my own internal voice. And I was like, this is really resonating for me. I really get this. And I just started typing an email to you there and then.
Well, I'm so glad you did. And I think, you know, it's so important, you know, this kind of resonating with people, and different people's stories are going to resonate with different people, which is why it's important to have different people's stories on, because not everybody is the same. But I think, you know, that's such a huge thing, isn't it? To see that kind of your story reflected in someone else's and, oh, what did they do? And what did they have success with or not in certain cases?
Exactly. And it's also, it depends what stage you're at of your journey as to what will resonate with you as well. Because if you hear something at the wrong time, or you're not ready to hear it or listen to it, it just flies straight over your head.
Yeah, exactly. Different things at different times. I think, again, yes, so important. So would you be able to just say a little bit about yourself and maybe what life was like in the before times?
Whenever I talk to anybody new anyway, I always feel like I have to explain the person I was before so that they can understand maybe a little bit about the person I am now. And I'm trying to drop it a little bit because I'm trying to learn that maybe not everybody needs to know what I was, and maybe I don't need to show everybody, look, this is the person who I thought I was, this amazing guy, when actually I'm quite happy with the person I'm becoming. So maybe I need to just drop some of that, but I'm not there yet. So the person who I was obviously still am happily married, two teenage sons, and pre-COVID I was like the all action dad. I was at weekends, I was on my road bike cycling 50 to 70 miles, just not even thinking about it. It was just, where shall I go for a cake and a cup of tea today? It's 30 miles away, off I go. And the next day I would say, right, which one of my sons wants to go for another bike ride? Or do we put a rucksack on? Do we go walking around the Norfolk coast? I just always felt like I was this action dad. Pull up my pants, we put the rucksacks on, off we go. And at work, I mean, I'm a director of a contracting company. So our days just, you can never plan the day. It changes on a phone call, and it's a heavily multitasking job mentally and physically. And I loved it. You know, you're doing this mental aerobics all day, every day. And I kind of loved everything about that. Or so I thought. And I think it's only on reflection that actually I probably wasn't where I should have been at the time, because I was heading for probably quite a dark place. I was fairly stressed out at work. My coping mechanisms for a stressful day was jump on my bike and do exercise. go for a run. My coping mechanisms are all about, right, I've had a bad day, and what can I blast myself with to get over it? So then suddenly to have all of that stripped away when COVID came was quite a hammer blow.
Yeah, absolutely. And I see a lot of myself in your story, which is, I guess, why you resonated with some of the stuff I was saying. And I think for me, part of recovery has been, I still have some of the same coping mechanisms that I did before. Like, I still blast myself with exercise some of the time, but I also know when not to do that, when actually maybe a healthier coping mechanism for me today, because I've had a really stressful day, maybe would be actually lying down and doing some breathing or baking a cake or, something that is a bit less sort of thrashing yourself. But I wouldn't have known that years and years ago. I just kept doing the same things because that's what I always did. And, that's how they become patterns, I suppose, isn't it? And why would you do something different? Because it's what you've always done.
It was a coping mechanism that I felt was really working well for me. And not only that, that was my identity. On my downtime, I was this fit, healthy, go-getting action dad is what I thought. And I thought that's what everybody needed from me, my wife, my family, my work. It's just, I think you hold this mental image of the person that you think you are, and you think that everybody wants you to be. And I think when that's stripped away from you, it's quite frightening, and it can be quite a scary process. When COVID came, it hit me like an absolute train. I really struggled with my breathing. I had to have oxygen sensors sent to me from the doctors just so they could keep a check of where my oxygen levels were. And I forget what the levels were, but I know that if I went down to a certain level and stayed there for an hour, then I had to call the hospital. And at times I was getting to 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and then suddenly my oxygen to go back up. So I'm struggling to breathe. And part of me was like, I quite want to get to the next 15 minutes because then maybe I can go to hospital and be looked at. It was bizarre how you almost felt like you wanted to get a little bit iller to get looked at. And I think luckily on reflection, I didn't have to go into hospital, but it did just. Yeah, it derailed me and hit me like a train wreck. And from listening to all of the stories and listening to your story as well, where the type of people before were heavy multitaskers, they were mentally agile, they were mentally busy, probably too busy, looking back on reflection. I think I was waiting for long COVID, really. I think my body was just always going to take the hit and run with long COVID. I was just made for it.
Again, on reflection, that was certainly where I was headed. If it hadn't have been COVID, then it would have been something else eventually. And that's quite a scary thought, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, that you were just describing, being the person that you thought people needed you to be. And this is something that I've noticed as well, and actually realizing that sometimes, in fact, maybe more than sometimes, I need to be the person that I need me to be rather than the person that someone else needs me to be. And I suppose that can be a difficult thing if you have people who are depending on you. I was lucky in some ways that I had a partner, but I didn't have kids. So I, didn't have that. But I also had all of these other things where I was like, oh, you should be doing this, pressure from work, pressure I was putting on myself, probably more than anything else. And you just feel yourself pulled in all these different directions and you can't really do anything about it because it's just what's happening. And but you do have kids. That must be quite a difficult thing. I found it hard enough to put myself first. How did you manage that, to kind of start putting yourself first when your body finally said, dude, you got to do this now? We'll be right back. I'm interrupting myself for a second to tell you about long COVID breathing. The fabulous Vicky Jones and I have teamed up to bring you long COVID breathing. We are both passionate about sharing our expertise and experience of the breath and how incredibly helpful that can be with long COVID. We've worked together to develop a course that is specifically tailored to those with long COVID. It's a 6-week course with 12 sessions, all delivered online. The community feel and learning that we're all sharing is such a joy. find out more information and to sign up for our courses, workshops and other shorter sessions, please check out the link below, longcovidbreathing.com, or email longcovidbreathing@gmail.com to start your breathing journey with us.
I would like to say that was an easy process, but that took 2 years, I think, and a lot of crash and burns. I was always quite proud of the fact, in my family setup, I've been the main wage earner for a long time. It's allowed my wife, Laura, to look after the children at the times when they were really young. And again, I've always loved that dynamic. I loved being the action dad. I loved being the main breadwinner. That was what I brought to the table. And I think a lot of it stems back to childhood, because my father and my grandfathers were very much of the, you know, we're men, we're strong, we go out to work, we don't cry, we don't really show our emotion. And if we do, we quickly brush it off, pull our socks up, because men don't cry. And that was kind of what was always drummed into me. And in and amongst my childhood, I had a couple of broken family units. So my mom got divorced a couple of times. So in and amongst that, you learn to be a little bit stronger, a little bit more resilient, a little bit, I don't want to be seen, because being seen is not always a good thing in a new family unit and a new family setup. So all of these coping mechanisms that I had for that time period, I thought were really good. They made me really resilient. They got me to where I am now. And initially, when I first started getting over COVID, I tried to go back to work after about 5 weeks. And I started off gently. So I was going in for 2 hours a day, because that was just all I could manage. Then I'd go home and I'd sleep pretty much till the next morning. And then I'd go to work and I'd maybe do 3 hours or do 4 hours. But my coping mechanism is, you know, if I'm the boss at work, if I'm not there, nobody's going to listen to me. Things are going to fall apart. The other directors aren't going to like that I'm not pulling my weight. It goes against my grain of, I'm a hard worker. I want to be the hardest worker in the room. Because if I'm not being the hardest worker in the room, then I'm somehow failing myself and everybody else around me. So that coping mechanism didn't really work very well for me at the time, because it just meant I just kept crashing and burning and crashing and burning. And I think what really drove it was last summer, I started to feel a little bit better. So I got to May time and I found that I woke up one morning and I just had a little bit of strength in my legs. And I was like, it's back. I've got power again. I can do stuff. So me being me, which is I have power, I must exercise, because exercise is the only thing that keeps me safe and keeps me stress-free and keeps me healthy. So a little bit of energy, I go out and I blast it away. I fall flat on my face for a couple of days. I then have another little bit of energy. I blast myself for a little bit longer. And so the cycle went on, and I got to a point where I could get on my bike for 5 or 10 miles. And I was like, this is it. I'm going to be fixed. And then one day I woke up and it's gone. And there's just, I think only a person who's known proper fatigue and proper illness, chronic illness, can know the feeling. And I woke up and I laid there in bed and I was like, it's gone. And that was the hardest time. I had a year and a half of getting to this point of where I thought it was back, and it just got took away again. And it absolutely destroyed me at the time. And I think on reflection, that's what I needed to happen, because I think otherwise I was just going to keep crashing and burning. But and I think what I really started to notice was I was crashing and burning on a daily basis. So I'd do too much sleep, do too much sleep, do too much sleep. But the big crash in the summer taught me that actually, as a life cycle, I was doing it massively in the background as well. And it just absolutely floored me at that point there. But yeah, going back to the earlier, but I just, my whole being for me was I must get back to work as quickly as possible. I must be earning for the family. I'm not being good to the family. I'm not being good to the children. I'm not being good to the wife. I'm not showing up for myself.
Yeah, I mean, it's so tough, isn't it? And I think if you do feel that little bit of something, a little bit of energy, a slightly better day, you know, we're so deprived of those things that we want to do, that of course we're going to want to go do something if we feel up to doing it. And I did this all the time, over and over and over. And, it's the most natural thing to want to do, but it is also the worst thing to do, isn't it? Because as you say, then you just crash and burn and you have a load more bad days. But then you might get a little glimmer of something else. Ah, I'll go do all the things. And I think for me, one of the hardest things was holding myself back on those better days and, using up maybe some of the energy, doing something that gave me some joy, but not going at it 100%, doing a taste of something and saving the rest of that energy to put back into the body for healing, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, the only way I could try to make people understand how I was feeling, and it was an analogy my wife Laura came up with it, and it was because on one of our walks, we were walking back to the house, and it was only a brief walk, maybe half a mile, something like that. And when the brain fog and the fatigue comes on, it was like I get drunk. My wife would have to hold my hand to stop me staggering off the curb, and she'd say, "It's just like you get drunk." And I was like, "Well, do you know what? That makes sense. You can understand that, and I understand it." So then I started to describe to everyone that I had this base level, and my base level was I'd had one or two beers, so I'm in a permanent state of slightly drunk, can hold a conversation, but not always going to be focused in the conversation. Will forget my words. I might forget what you're telling me at any time because my attention's wandered. And if I have to do something mental, say be on a phone call or just talking to people, or if I try and do a little bit of exercise and walking, it was like I'd had another beer. And then if I talk a bit more, I've had another beer. If I walk a bit further, I had another beer. And I was never very good at learning how to bring the levels back down. So all I would do is, in my mind, was drink, 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 get to the point of where you fall flat on your face. And then you have the most horrendous hangover for a day, 1 week, 2 weeks, a month. And that just seemed like a very good way that people seemed to understand that. Even though they couldn't understand fatigue, they couldn't understand brain fog, they could go, "Yeah, I get what you mean. I've been drunk and I lose track of a conversation when I'm drunk." And for some reason, that just kind of resonated with a few people. So that became an easy thing to say to people. "I've had about five beers today. I'm not really in a very good place. And if I do too much, suddenly I'm going to be on 10 beers and I'm going to fall fast asleep."
Brilliant. And you know what? I think if you're speaking to someone who has long COVID or has had long COVID or any condition that's kind of related to that, we get it. And I think that's why things like support groups, all of these things that give us validation and connection with other people who get it, I think that's important. But I think it's really important to be able to connect to people outside of that as well. Your family, friends, work colleagues, for people who are working, because it can be very easy to get that disconnect between the ill people and the non-ill people. So having some way that we can communicate that in a way that they can sort of relate to. And I think your beer analogy is brilliant. It does that because, like you say, everyone's had too much to drink. They found themselves stumbling along the pavement, not remembering where the train station is. And everyone's woken up the next morning and gone, "Oh my goodness, what did I do?" So people can relate to that, I think.
Definitely. And I think one of the things that got me in the summer months when I had this, I'm hoping my final crash, because there was a podcast that I was listening to with you, and I forget the person, but she was talking about how you can be washed up on a beach and how you can be bashed about in the ocean, and then you get washed back up on the beach, and then you have to dust yourself off and start climbing and working. And that was still kicking around in my head. It was resonating, but for differing reasons for me. And how I felt at the time was, I've been roughing around in the sea now for 2 years, and I felt like I'd been spat out on this little beach in the middle of nowhere. And it was like an island, and I'm surrounded by the horrendous seas. And the reason that I'd got to this island was because I'd recently found breathing. And again, it was through one of your podcasts, I became aware of the breathing cure and the James Nestor book. So you had Patrick McEwan and James Nestor, and I was reading both of those books. realizing that I have the worst breath hold possible. I had like a Bolt score of 2 when I first started doing it. And I was like, I can hold my breath. Of course I can hold my breath. And then you try to and you realize I'm drowning. And I just started to recognize that and started to do lots of breathing exercises. So the point of when I sent you the email was like, I've got this little island. I've managed to calm myself down. I'm only on one beer a day at the moment. And I know that the moment I do anything, I'm going to go to 2 beers. But I now have this little coping mechanism where I can put my headphones in and I can do breathing for 10 minutes and I get myself back down to one. So I kind of felt this analogy of I'm just stuck on this little lonely island. I'm quite happy to be there at the moment, but I don't know how to get off the island. I don't know if I want to get off the island at the moment because I've spent 2 years in the sea. And it was a twofold thing. It was finding breath, which is incredible, which I never thought I'd ever say to myself. And also at the point of when I was probably had my biggest crash, I just came home from work and I cried for it must have been hours. It was just the worst time, I think, and the lowest I've ever felt. And at that time, I had both my wife, Laura, saying to me, you know, maybe it's time to go and talk to somebody. And I've got a really good friend at work who's also my boss. And he was saying, you know, maybe it's time to go and talk to somebody. And they've both been saying this over a number of years. My friend at work, Rob, especially, has been saying it for a number of years. And I was like, I don't need to talk to people. You know, I've got over bigger things in my life. I'm a big, strong man. I don't need somebody to tell me how to fix myself. I don't need somebody to tell me what's wrong with me. I don't need that. I can do all of this myself. And then at the lowest point, I thought, yeah, do you know what? Now probably is the time to look into that. And yeah, I came across this lovely therapist called Amy. And together, I would say, we started to unpick where I was as a person and start to analyze a lot of different areas of my life, really.
Yeah, I think the episode that you talked about was it was Michelle Irvin, which I will put the link in the show notes for anyone wanting to work out what we're talking about. And it was interesting speaking to her because I remember having this realization where I think I had just recovered when I'd spoke to her, and I was going through this weird like, I'm better. What do I do now? Which was really strange because I thought, you know, that you recovered and then everything was great. And it was, don't get me wrong, but it was almost like, you know, she said, yeah, you know, physically, you're at number four, you're good, but emotionally, you're way out at sea because you have no idea what's going on. And that really stuck with me because I thought, yeah, you're right. I'm completely at sea. I have literally no idea what's going on. And that's a really scary place to be, either physically or emotionally or both. So I think, you know, then, as you say, washing up on that beach, it's kind of just like, okay, right, give me a minute, kind of feeling, isn't it? Where you've just got to kind of take stock. And but I'm a massive fan of the breath, obviously, because that's what I'm now doing with my life. And it was, yeah, it was huge for me. And, you know, realizing that, as you say, you know, there are things that you do, or sometimes things that you don't do, that give you more beers, to use your analogy. You know, those beers will stack up, and sometimes there's nothing you can really do about it. And sometimes you know what caused them to stack up, and sometimes it's less obvious. But actually having some sort of a tool that can reduce the beers, that's a hugely powerful thing. You know, okay, things are not going well. Let's use this particular breathing exercise. Okay, let's reduce the beers. It's a very, very kind of powerful, sort of empowering moment, I think, isn't it, to be able to do that? We'll be right back. Hey there, I'm just jumping in for a second to see if you're enjoying this episode. If you're finding it useful, maybe you would consider sharing it somewhere, a friend, a group, or even on your Twitter feed. If everyone was able to share just once, we'd be able to get this information out to even more people who really, really need it. So please consider sharing somewhere if you possibly can. I hope you enjoy the episode, and thank you so much.
Yeah, I mean, I spent 2 years. I couldn't control anything about my body and my brain. It's running away, and it's like a wild horse that you just cannot jump on. And if you do manage to get on, you're thrown flat on your face. And I suddenly found something, as daft as I thought it was at the time I came across it, that I was like, I have control of something. For the first time in 2 years, I can control something about my body. And the thing I'm actively choosing to do for once is not making me fall on my face. Actually, it's having a positive benefit. And that was so empowering. It was like, it was a light bulb moment. And the bizarrest thing in, we talk about how things resonate with people. When I'd heard in the last 2 years about breathing, I'd heard little things about parasympathetic systems and dysautonomia and dysfunctional breathing. I'd heard all of these terms, but because of where I was at in my journey, I was like, nah, I don't need that. I just need to get better so I can walk 5 miles. I just need to go for a run. I just need to do whatever I need to do. And in meeting with Amy, I mean, the bizarrest thing is I met Amy last year for about 10 weeks. We had a death in the family, which upset me at the time quite a lot. And I chose to go and speak to Amy about my family and how my childhood was. And I spent 10 weeks with her, and me being me, it coincided at the same time with I can now walk a little bit further. I can now go on my bike for a mile. I'm cured. I don't need Amy. I parked there. She was gone. But Amy was gone. I'm off. I'm running. The old Peter's coming back. And then he was until I had my biggest crash to date. And I heard you speaking about having your big final crash once on one of your podcasts. And at that point, not that I realized it, that was my biggest crash to date. And I should have seen it coming because now looking back on it, all the signs were there. I was starting to get drunker and drunker again. I was starting to find myself tearful at difficult conversations, although I hid it really well. I was finding I'd have to take myself out from work because mentally I wasn't functioning well, but I didn't want anybody to see that because that didn't fit with the narrative of who I was or who I thought I was. And at home as well with my wife, we have a great relationship and we talk a lot, but I didn't realize how much I didn't talk about certain things as well. And it wasn't till I started to speak again back to Amy at the lowest point I think I've ever been at, and lots of tearful sessions and lots of hard sessions where when you find a good therapist to talk to, they don't fix you. They don't tell you what you are. They don't tell you what you're not. They don't tell you where you're going wrong. They just somehow allow you to talk. And many times I'd walk and sit down in a chair and go, I've got nothing to talk about because that's just my defense mechanism. People aren't allowed to see me. I don't talk. And I'd just talk for a whole hour. I would be in tears. She would ask one simple question and it would set me off. And then I'd be like, why does that hit me so hard? Why does that resonate so deep? Just one silly little question, which if somebody asked me outside of these four walls, it wouldn't bother me at all. Or not that I'm aware of, it wouldn't bother me. But yet the whole process of finding Amy and learning to talk to somebody who's, and I think the biggest thing about it was it's so non-judgmental. And I think that's what I needed in my journey at that time, because you talk to your wife or you talk to your friends, it's almost like once you've said something, that thing is there forever. Whereas when you're in the confines of this room with somebody who you're slowly starting to trust, and they don't judge you or they don't appear to judge you, and you can say something and it never leaves the room. That's so freeing. You could start to talk about all of these fears and anxieties that you didn't always know were there, but were slowly coming up the more you find out about yourself.
Yeah, you're right. And it's almost like a good therapist. They don't tell you what to do.
they help you to work it out yourself, I think, which I suppose is another one of those kind of empowering things. But it's like you need someone there kind of poking you, asking those difficult questions, putting you in those places where you really don't want to be, but you kind of need to be in order to work out what's going on and stuff. I think this was really interesting because, and I had a sort of similar moment to you where I don't need to talk to someone. No, I don't need to talk to someone. I've got my partner. I don't need to talk to someone. Oh, I need to talk to someone who's not my partner so I can say those things. And it's a kind of like, oh, yeah, that seems really obvious when someone points it out to you. But I think that was one of the best decisions I made was starting to speak to somebody. And I think mental health is taboo anyway. It's getting less taboo, and I think that's good, but it's still something that people don't really want to talk about. And I think, especially in chronic illness circles, it's even more taboo because people are worried about being told, oh, I told you it was just anxiety, which it's not. I'm anxious because I'm ill. But people once bitten, twice shy. Not every doctor will gaslight you, but unfortunately, there are enough out there that will, that people are a little bit concerned. And Dr. Jim Jackson said that untreated mental health is just as bad as untreated physical health. And I think he's right. And I think maybe what kind of resonated with me so much in your email when you sent it to me was that on top of all of that, mental health and being a man, this is like an extra thing on top, I think, or certainly can be.
It can feel like I can only speak from the sort of the man perspective, and I think men of my generation and above, we're not meant to cry, we're not meant to show weakness. And I've got two teenage sons who I'm very conscious that I know that that's not right, but the things that I want them to be able to talk, I want them to be open, I want them to share their opinions and not feel judged for it. I think I learned through all of my conversations with Amy that the things that I want from for other people and expect for other people, that they can talk, they can do all these things, are not the same expectations that I had on myself. And the phrase, you're not being a good friend to yourself, I've heard many a time. And I never really understood what that phrase was until Amy would sometimes say, would you expect that of your children? What would you say if your children said that? Or what would you say if your wife said that to you? Or what would you say if your friend said that to you? I'd say, well, that's absolute nonsense. Of course they should feel this way. So why are you not allowed to feel like that? Why are you not allowed to feel scared? And there was many moments like that of, you need to be a better friend to yourself, Peter. And that was probably the only real time I ever got given advice was, you need to be a good friend to yourself. You need to hold your own hand. You need to give yourself your own cuddle, which was all things that I would do for everybody else. But for me, no, that was the hardest thing because that's not what I do. That's not what men of my generation do. We pull our socks up. We get on with it. We don't show weakness. And that's a hard thing to overcome. Because, like you say, other men of my generation that I talk to, they go, oh, you're just a bit stressed at work. Why don't you go and have a beer? If I took long COVID out of the equation, I wouldn't be stressed. Actually, I probably would be stressed with the work that I do, but I wouldn't be as stressed. I wouldn't be as anxious. I would be able to do fun things in my life. So not only have I got the stress of work, I've got no fun things in my life. At that point where I had my crash, all I was doing was just doing enough to get through the day. And then there was nothing left for my family. So I had no energy left in the evenings to spend what I felt was quality time with my sons or my wife. We'd get to a weekend and I knew I just had to sleep all weekend because otherwise I'm not going to get through work next week. And mentally, for me as a man, that was like, you're just not showing up for yourself. You're going to have all this stigma from the whole world that, you're a man, you shouldn't be like this. Pull your socks up, be strong. That's a hard dynamic, and that's one that took a lot of convincing me that it's okay to be okay with my feelings, and more than that, to be seen, to allow people to see me upset. Like, there was things that I wouldn't want to say to Laura, because I knew that if I said them, it would upset her. And my role as a husband is, I don't want to make my wife upset. So therefore, if I hold these things, and I didn't realize I was doing it, but if I hold these things and I hide them, you know, she's not going to be as stressed. She's not going to be as worried. She's not going to be upset for me. So in trying to protect everybody around me, I was doing the opposite. I just didn't realize it.
Yeah, and it makes me think of the analogy of the oxygen masks in the aeroplane. And they always say, put your own oxygen mask on before you put anyone else's on. And like, I always used to think that that sounded the wrong way around. It was like, well, surely if there's someone there that can't get their mask on, then you should be helping them. You know, you can do yours afterwards. And then it wasn't until after I was unwell that I realized, oh, well, if you don't have your mask on, you're in no position to help anybody else. And I think that's entirely relevant here. And I do the same. I put everybody else first. You know, oh, well, you know, I'll do this because it'll make it easier for someone else. You know, always been a people pleaser, although I wouldn't have realized it until now. And, you know, yeah, of course you want to make life easier for your wife. Of course you want to show up for your kids. You need to do your job. You need to do all these things. But actually, you need to look after number one first, because otherwise you can't be there for anybody else who needs you.
It is definitely. You don't realize it. And I think without being able to talk to Amy, and again, it's that just that non-judgmental setting where you can say the most outlandish thing and you know it's not going to go anywhere. You can say, Amy, I am the worst husband. I am the worst father. I'm just useless. I can't do the things I want to do. Who's going to love a man like that? All of these fears and anxieties that I'm going to be ill forever. How do I cope with that? That was where my thought process was at the time. I'm a rubbish husband, I'm rubbish at work, I'm a rubbish dad, I'm a rubbish man. To mentally get your head around all of those aspects was really difficult and really challenging. And when I really did hit, I'm going to say it was rock bottom, because I'm hoping that's what it was at the time, but when I did hit rock bottom, I suddenly became aware of a lot of things. So one was breathing, one bizarrely was your podcast. Another one was I started to hear things. It was almost like I was hearing things in the back of my mind going, there must be a podcast on long COVID. There must be something about breathing. There was just these little niggly things in the back of my head. And I said, oh, I'm going to have a little look at that. And I mean, Amy, when we've been talking about it, we kind of come to the assumption that these things were always there. It's just I wasn't ready for them. So I would maybe see that there was a long COVID podcast, but I didn't want to join into that. I would see that there was something about breathing out there. I didn't want to join into that because I wasn't ready to hear it at that point. And I think that was probably the biggest thing for me. I think I needed to hit rock bottom to suddenly go, do you know what? I'm not fixing myself here. I think all of my coping mechanisms are just making me worse. And I know if I pick myself up, I'll slowly get a little bit better. And I'm going to probably have a harder crash in 6 months' time. And it was just, it was like a light bulb moment. And I had to be flat on the floor to realize it. I needed to talk to someone. I needed to look out there for help. I think I needed to admit I needed help. And I don't think I was ready to admit that. Not outwardly. I think I admitted it to myself for a while. But I think the moment you say to somebody, I need a little bit of help, you can't take it back. And I think I was always too scared to be able to do that. Again, it goes back to man of my generation, can't admit that I have feelings, can't admit that, do you know what, sometimes I cry because I'm crying for the person that I didn't realize at the time that I once was. And I came to understand that I was actually grieving this person. I was grieving the person who I thought was amazing. And it's only really now I can sit here, and it's only really happened recently as well. I've stopped the grief for that man that I used to be, because actually I think there's elements of that man that I love and I think helped me to get to where I am, made me strong, made me resilient. But if someone said to me now, we're going to move forward and you can go back and you can be this man, I don't think I'd want to be, because I think I was too stressed. I think I was in a place where I didn't understand me. I didn't understand my feelings. And my coping mechanisms were only going to get me so far, because if it wasn't long COVID, I think something else was probably going to happen to me. And it was the first time ever I went, I don't really want to be him anymore. I think I want to keep some of the aspects. I'd like to be fit again like that one day. That's one thing I'd quite like, but I don't want a lot of the baggage I was carrying mentally and physically at that time. And that, again, that was quite freeing to admit to myself and to actually say out loud to other people as well.
Yeah, it's scary, I think, to sort of start thinking those things. And then to say them out loud is like a whole different, you know, because it's putting it out there, isn't it? You know, I can relate to so much of what you just said. You know, you wanted nothing more than to be the person you were before. And the fact that you couldn't be that person was absolutely devastating. So you fight sort of tooth and nail to be that person, but in doing so you make things worse because the coping mechanisms that that person had were not the ones that you need right now. And like you say, admitting, again, it almost feels like something naughty or something dirty, doesn't it, to admit that you need help. And it shouldn't be. It should be something that we're able to do a lot more, but obviously it wasn't something that came naturally to you, or easily to you anyway. It certainly wasn't something that came easily to me, because I've always been a just get on with it, because that's the message I've had ever since childhood. And you know, I think it's very similar for lots of other people. It is very, very difficult to sort of make that, how do they, make that first step, almost. But once you do, certainly for me, and it sounds like you've had a similar experience, once you do kind of put your hand up and say, I need some help, it is very kind of liberating, I think. You know, it's like it's out there now.
Again, that goes back to that. You need that person who's non-judgmental and is trapped in these four walls. You need to find that for yourself. It really is freeing. But yeah, I'd come out of there blurting some horrendous stuff out and then feeling so childish. Like, what a childish thought. Why would I think such a thing? And I've come to learn that we've all got this chorus in us of our old self and our different age groups. And the one thing I've been trying to do is when I have a feeling of, oh, that's a really childish thing to think, Peter, I'm like stopping and going, okay, what sort of age do I feel at the moment I said that? And you can kind of almost narrow it down to a time period in your life of you go, okay, was it when I was in my 20s? Yeah, I did have that feeling, but it was there. So was it when I was in my teens? Was it from the age of around 10? And you can sometimes narrow it down to a time period. And you remember where you were and what you were doing and what was going on around you at that period and go, oh, I can understand why I'm feeling those things, why it now hits me like it does. And it's all that self-reflection that you can do again in those safe four walls that you can talk about this and it's no one's ever going to repeat it to you. Yet the fear always is if you say something to your partner or your wife or a friend and in 2 years' time, that thing could be spoken about. And in 2 years' time, you might not want to talk about those things because that was a different time period and you're embarrassed about the thing you said. It's only through therapy with Amy and talking about all these things and learning about myself that I realized that actually, if you do say it to the people you love and you trust them, it's not a bad feeling, because I've always prided myself in being a really good listener. I want people to come and talk to me. People have a problem, talk to me. I love other people's problems. I'll listen to them all day long. I never quite realized how much sometimes I take on the emotion and I hold on to their emotion. And that was not something I ever realized I did until my bucket is overflowing with my own emotion, that actually somebody else's emotion also sets me off. And I'm like, why am I? And it was just because I didn't have that resilience anymore. To my bucket was overflowing, was another phrase that I came to understand quite quickly. And yeah, I tended to be filling my bucket from other people's buckets. I was becoming like, come and empty your bucket into mine, it's okay. And yeah, I suddenly realized that great, I want to listen and I want to help, but I had to try to learn not to be filling my own bucket up from their bucket. And also vice versa, because subconsciously I think I knew that was happening. I knew if I went to my wife and said, you know, Lord, you know what, I'm really scared about the future. What if this is me as a man forevermore? I didn't want the answer. And I also didn't want to pour my bucket into her bucket, for want of a better description. I don't want her to own my problems, my issues. And it was listening to you and your partner when he was questioning you, I suddenly realized that, wow, you are so open. Like on a real, I feel broken fundamental level, that as much as I talked to Laura and as much as I talked to my friends, I was never that open. And I was like, wow, that's a place I think I need to try and get to.
It's really interesting, isn't it? And again, it comes back to our own boundaries and what we can handle. And that's going to be different for each individual person and each individual situation and any different day if we're talking about long COVID, because no 2 days are ever the same. But absolutely, you know, being open and being able to talk about these things, but also knowing when it's too much to put onto someone else, and vice versa, knowing when someone else is putting too much onto you and when you need to say, actually, no, I'm not going to be your person today. I might be able to be your person another time, but right now, I don't have any bucket left. It's hard because I think it's important to talk, but how do you know how much of someone else's bucket there is? And I think something that my partner and I have found quite useful, not so much in this sense, but more in the fact that I talk a lot. I come off a Zoom call, I need to go tell someone about it. Oh, I met this really great person and this amazing thing happened and they said this and it was great. And then we went and talked about this thing and, you know, I'm starting to get tired just thinking about all the things that I do. And sometimes he's really interested and he's happy to let me just kind of talk myself out. And sometimes he just wants quiet. He wants me to not do that. And I found it really difficult to work out when I could do that and when I couldn't, because either I would go and do it and he'd be fine, or I'd get a couple of minutes in and he'd just go, stop. And I would get incredibly defensive because I was unwell and I didn't take rejection very well, probably even before I was unwell, if I'm completely honest. But, you know, he would sort of say something in a way that made me just feel so much worse. So it was like, how do we deal with this? So we're not perfect at it, but I'm better at when I come off a Zoom call and I'm like, I ask him if he can handle it. It's like, can I talk at you? And often he's like, sure, go for it. And some of the time he's like, I need quiet time. And I'm getting better at being able to respect that. So it's almost like you need some sort of way of saying, can I or can't I? Whether it's kind of like deep, dark, soul searching sort of honesty, or I just need a wall to talk at.
One of the things I always struggled with, I would say to one of my sons, you know, tomorrow, why don't we go and do such and such? And they would look all excited about the, whatever the thing may be. It might be, let's go down the coast and we'll have a little wander, we'll eat some chips, anything. And you'd wake up and that morning was the morning when you knew you weren't going, she shouldn't get out of bed. And for 2 years, you'd get out of bed and you'd see them. I was still going to the coast today to eat some chips. And you know that you probably shouldn't do it because you've just got no energy. And you know tomorrow you're going to be even worse if you do it. But the little look on the faces of the people that you love when they can sense that you're not in a good place, but they don't quite know to say, do you know what, Dad, let's not do that today. And you can't ever expect that of your children anyway. And because I'm an absolute people pleaser when it comes to my children and my wife, I would just do it. and I would fall flat on my face. And there's times when maybe we're walking down the beach at Hunstanton before we would get chips, and there's a cafe at the end of one of the beaches, and I would sit on a rock. And this happened on New Year's Day. My wife's parents were there, and they're both in their 70s, and I felt like I was 170. I was 20 paces behind, and I couldn't keep up. I could have just fallen flat on my face in the sand. But me being me, I didn't want to let anyone down. I didn't want to let my children down. I didn't want to upset my wife because she'd planned something with the parents. I'm Peter. It's what I've always done. I work through rubbish. I can just do it. And we got to the end, and I said, why don't you go get a cup of tea and I'll just sit on this rock? Half an hour later, I woke up on this rock, and they were all around me. They both had two cups of tea. I'd had one cup of tea that had gone cold, and I've got another one sitting there. And I was like, what's going on? She went, you just fell asleep on the rock, and we didn't have the heart to wake you. And that little look from your children, and you do not want to upset them. I don't want to upset my wife by admitting that I'm ill, I can't do these things. Because you ultimately, you really want to do it. But I think for me, I always felt less of a man for not being able to do something. And forgetting long COVID and forgetting that I was ill, on a cellular level, it just felt like I'm not a man if I can't do these things. I'm not a man if I can't take that phone call at work. What sort of man am I if I can't take my children, even for a walk? That comes back to that. I just needed to learn to ask for help myself. Because Amy would say to me, what if Laura was saying to you, you know, I've got a headache today, I don't fancy going for a walk. Would you make her? No, of course I wouldn't do. I'd say, well, let's watch a film. Let's snuggle up on the sofa. Let's do something else. And it was in one of the sessions where she turned around to me. She said, you're denying people that opportunity to do that for you. Can't compute that sentence. What do you mean? She said, well, you love helping people. You love listening to people. If somebody's ill, you love to snuggle up on the sofa with them. But you deny them the fundamental opportunity to do that back to you. You're denying your wife the opportunity to say, come and snuggle beside me. I'll put my arm around you. It was another one of those sessions where I lost it and was crying. And I was like, I've never looked at it that way. Again, that was quite an eye-opener for me. The thing I love to do for my family, I was denying that they could do that for me. And that was quite a powerful realization, really. Again, born out of me, man, me not cry.
That's beautiful. I love that. And again, that it's okay to not be able to do things. You know, we have this kind of drive, don't we, that in order to be successful, in order to be worthy, we have to be doing things that we've always been told we need to do, the things society tells us we need to do, the things that we tell ourselves that we need to do. And actually, we don't, but it can be difficult to realize that. And that certainly was something that happened for me, you know, that to realize that I was worthy as a person, whatever else happened.
You're never going to know that for yourself. When you come to realize these little snippets about your own psychology, and it hits hard. It's probably not a good life lesson for my children as men, that actually dad doesn't show his feelings and dad's not willing to say, I need help here, guys.
One of my big lessons is that I need to say no to things, because I've never said no to anything in my life until this happened. So, you know, I started saying no to things. But actually, as you've just demonstrated, that actually sometimes we need to say yes to things, you know, things that we might not want to say yes to. But actually, yeah, someone's offered to do something for me. Yes, that's probably a good yes moment.
Not everybody can afford to go to therapy, but maybe they might be able to find someone who they don't feel judgment from and say to them, do you know what, guys? I just need to talk, and I really don't want you to fix me, because that's the worst thing. You never want to say anything deep to somebody you think they're going to try and fix you. I just want to talk. Please ask me a question. Just don't give me any advice, because that's the last thing that any of us wants in that time period. You just want to talk. And I think that's kind of the message I wanted to get out there, really, that you know, we're men. We can talk and we do cry, and it's a good thing. We're crying for a reason. And if we're not admitting it to people, then we're not admitting it to ourselves.
I think everyone finds it hard to talk about things, and I think, you know, certain people, men definitely being one of those groups, can find it even harder. So thank you so much for putting yourself out there and for coming along and chatting to me today and sharing everything that you have. Thank you so much.
It's been cleansing.
Thank you so much to all of my guests and to you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it, or at least found it useful. The Long COVID podcast is entirely self-produced and self-funded. I'm doing all of this myself. If you're able to, please go to buymeacoffee.com/longcovidpod to help me cover the costs of hosting the podcast. Please look out for the next episode of the Long COVID podcast. It's available on all the usual podcast hosting things. And do get in touch. I'd love to hear from you.